Hi, this is Ted, and for the next hour, you'll be listening to a reading of articles and features from the Monday, October 27th New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Start with a front page article. In Trump-friendly Iowa, his policies have hurt. By Pooja Salhotra. When President Trump announced a $20 billion bailout for Argentina this month, Larry Ori, a farmer in Earlham, Iowa, could hardly believe it, especially after boatloads of Argentine soybeans began shipping to China, a once critical customer for Mr. Ori's family. For Iowans, losing China's soybean market in the president's trade war was only one of many economic shocks that have hit the state since the start of Trump's second term. The cost of tractors and fertilizers have shot up with his tariffs. Labor has grown scarcer in agribusinesses. Major manufacturers have laid off workers. Even the ubiquitous wind turbines that provide income for some Iowa farmers are in the president's sight. Right now, we're fighting different economic wars all at once, said Summer Ori, the wife of Mr. Ori's grandson, Dan. The couple works in the family's farm business. You can sustain one at a time, but right now it's death by a thousand cuts. Ms. Ori said she votes in every election, but she, like Mr. Ori, declined to say who she cast her ballot for last November. In a possible lifeline for Iowa farmers like the Ori's, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent hinted at a deal on soybeans in the initial framework of an agreement that U.S. and Chinese trade negotiators reached on Sunday, but he gave no specifics. I believe when the announcement of the deal with China is made public, our soybean farmers will feel very good about what's going on, both for this season and the coming seasons for several years, he said. Since siding with Barack Obama twice, Iowa has become a stronghold for Trump, yet perhaps no state has struggled more with his economic policies. During the first quarter of 2025, Iowa's gross domestic product dropped 6.1%, more than any other state aside from neighboring Nebraska. Manufacturing, which drives 17% of Iowa's economic output, has been hit with higher production costs, in part because of deep tariffs on inputs like aluminum and steel. Meatpacking plants, which help make Iowa the nation's leading pork producers, rely heavily on foreign born workers, hundreds of thousands of whom saw their legal status stripped away by the president. Trump's war on renewable energy also threatens the wind industry that produces more than half of Iowa's electricity. Some of the state's troubles, like bad weather, high interest rates, an aging and shrinking rural population and global commodity prices, are beyond the president's control. But new economic policies have magnified the state's woes, according to economists, agricultural groups, and some business leaders. This is as challenging as I've seen it, Kirk Leeds, the chief executive of the Iowa Soybean Association, said. We've got uncertainties beyond compare. Next year's midterm elections could indicate how Iowans feel about these policies. At least two competitive House districts will be up for a vote. The state will also choose a replacement for its retiring governor, Kim Reynolds, and retiring Senator, Joni Ernst. All those posts are held by Republicans. People are hurting everywhere in Iowa, and they're looking for something different, said Josh Turek, a Democratic state House member running for Ms. Ernst's seat. Trump has argued that the tariffs will help protect American jobs and rectify trade imbalances, while enforcing immigrant laws will free up work for citizens. There's no shortage of American minds and hands to grow our labor force, said Abigail Jackson, a White House spokeswoman, who said that the president was capitalizing on that untapped potential while delivering on our mandate to enforce our immigration laws. And many Iowans remain loyal. Doug Keller, 63, who farms about 15 miles southwest of Waterloo, said he was hopeful the president will reach a new trade deal with China that will benefit farmers in the long run. Money is tighter than it should be, said another Iowan, Matt Wyatt, who works with Mr. Keller to grow corn and soybeans on close to 1,500 acres of land. But we try to stay optimistic around here. For now, times are tough. Iowa is the country's largest producer of corn and second largest producer of soybeans. America exports as much as half its soybeans, and the vast majority of that has gone to China, $12.6 million worth last year. But this year, China stopped purchasing soybeans from the United States to retaliate against Trump's tariffs. American producers have spent decades working with people in China on how to use soy in animal feed, part of an effort to build up that growing market. Mr. Leeds said he has traveled to the country 25 times and used dollars paid by Iowa farmers to foster strong bonds with Chinese importers. I'm not exactly sure how we repair some of those relationships, he said. The president's bailout of his ally, President Javier Milei of Argentina, has rankled many Iowans since China moved immediately after it was announced to lock up Argentine soybeans exports to fill the gap from Beijing's boycott of American soy. Who are you subsidizing, our competitions or us? Larry Ori asked. Iowa's large beef industry then recoiled after Trump suggested he would try to lower the cost of beef by importing more from Argentina. Brian Whaley, the chief executive of the Iowa Cattlemen's Association, said Trump's comments roiled cattle markets and a volatile market provides less of an opportunity for our producers, cattlemen and women here in Iowa, to make decisions that are going to help keep them profitable and viable. The president said he will take some money raised by his tariffs and give it to farmers as a bailout, but that's not necessarily welcome news. We would much rather farm with no federal assistance whatsoever, Mr. Wyatt said. We want to be able to sell our products for a good value, and normally we can. John Gilbert, a farmer in Iowa Falls, said he expected the government payments to favor large agribusinesses and to drive more consolidation in an industry that has been dominated by big corporations. The payments are skewed to the bigger guys, he said. Growers are also contending with tariff-induced price increases on seeds and fertilizer, some of which is imported from Russia and Canada. Prices for monoammonium phosphate, a fertilizer with both nitrogen and phosphorus, are up 14%, according to the Department of Agriculture. As he deals with those higher prices, Aaron Lehman, a fifth-generation farmer in a rural part of Polk County, said he'll continue to use his more than 25-year-old Warren combine, a machine with greater power and a more sophisticated GPS system would cost upwards of $100,000 used and more than $250,000 new, he said. Mr. Lehman wondered whether his 26-year-old son could realistically earn a living working full-time on the family farm. Our farms and lots of farms are having to reassess if there's a real opportunity for years down the road, he said. The economic pain has spread beyond agriculture to truckers who transport seeds and grains, agronomists who help farmers innovate, and the Main Street restaurants where farmers eat and drink. Everywhere you turn, people are asking, how are you going to make it, Ms. Ori said. Dan Ori, her husband, called it the perfect storm. John Deere, a leading manufacturing employer that makes agricultural equipment, has laid off hundreds of workers from its Iowa factories this year as sales decline and tariffs on steel and aluminum cost the company more than $300 million. Employment in Iowa's food manufacturing is down, too. Peter Orazim, an economics professor at Iowa State, linked that to layoffs of migrant workers. JBS Foods, a Brazilian meat packer, laid off approximately 200 workers from Haiti, Cuba, El Salvador, and Honduras at a plant in Atumwa in June, said Paulina Osegueda, vice president for the local chapter of LULAC, a Hispanic civil rights organization. It's not costless to replace that number of workers, Dr. Orazim said. He added that it was difficult to find domestic workers to take these jobs. In Waterloo, some Haitian workers lost jobs at a Tyson pork processing plant, said Yves Florina, a community outreach coordinator for World Grace Project, which helps refugees and other new immigrants in Waterloo find employment. Workers had received letters from the Department of Homeland Security telling them their legal immigration status would be terminated and they should leave the country, he said. Tricia McLaughlin, Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security, said humanitarian parole programs undercut American workers and allowed poorly vetted people into the country. JBS employs more than 5,000 people at four production facilities in Iowa, according to Nikki Richardson, a spokeswoman for the company. Two more plants are under construction and expected to create close to 1,000 additional jobs in Iowa. We're focused on hiring team members who are legally authorized to work in the U.S. and will continue to follow the guidance provided to us by the U.S. government, she said. Tyson did not respond to requests for comment. Iowa has a long history of welcoming immigrants. In the 1970s, Robert Ray, a former Iowa governor, accepted thousands of refugees from Southeast Asia who were displaced after the Vietnam War. The state continued to bring in refugees and ranked 13th in the country for refugee arrivals per capita, according to a 2023 report. Other immigrants are drawn to Iowa's quiet towns and factory jobs, said Alejandra Escobar, the lead organizer for Escucha Mi Voz, an immigrant-led advocacy group based in Iowa City. Immigration and Customs Enforcement does not appear to have conducted workplace raids in Iowa this year, but fear has permeated several cities, according to church leaders and some local officials. At La Placita, a Hispanic grocery store, taqueria, and meat market in Waterloo, business has declined by 25% over the past 3 months, its owner said. Iowa's renewable energy sector is also facing uncertainty, driven by what appears to be the president's personal animus toward wind power. The Trump administration and Congress have cut funding for major renewable projects, phased out renewable energy tax credits, and issued new rules to make it harder for some projects to qualify for those credits. The impacts might be modest in Iowa, according to Steve Geyer, a senior lawyer at Iowa Environmental Council, because the state is already heavily invested in wind energy. Still, he said, the new rules must be navigated while tariffs raise the cost of new turbines. And here's an environmental story. Heat virtually wipes out two key coral species off Florida, like Katrine Einhorn. After a searing ocean heat wave in 2023, two of the most historically important coral species in Florida are functionally extinct from the state's reef, scientists have found. Elkhorn and staghorn coral, known for their branching limestone arms that create incomparable reef habitat, have all but vanished everywhere except the northernmost sections of the reef, according to research published on Thursday in the journal Science. Those that remain are so diminished that they are not able to contribute to the ecosystem in a meaningful way, the author said. The findings are a bracing example of the toll that climate change is wreaking on the world's coral reefs, which support an estimated quarter of marine species, including fish that provide crucial protein and income in coastal communities. Reefs also protect coasts from storms, and elkhorn coral's tall branches are especially important in breaking the energy of waves. Scientists have been warning of this for quite literally decades, said Andrew Baker, a professor of marine biology at the University of Miami and one of the authors of the study. The surprise is that it happened so fast, and it wasn't more deaths by a thousand cuts. It was a sudden, final kind of guillotine. That guillotine was a record-breaking marine heat wave that hit Florida in 2023. At the time, conservationists raced to pull corals out of the water and house them in tanks in a desperate effort to save some genetic diversity. It was the ninth known mass bleaching to hit Florida's coral reef. The first occurred in 1987. When corals are stressed, they lose the algae they rely on for survival and will die unless conditions improve quickly. In 2023, corals there experienced heat stress that was 2 to 4 times greater than any other year on record. Temperatures were so high that some died even before bleaching, their tissue just sloughing off. One of the most biodiverse ecosystems on the planet, coral reefs are sometimes called rainforests of the sea. But they are sensitive to changes in temperature and have limited ability to migrate. As humans raise the planet's temperature by burning fossil fuels and destroying forests, the world's oceans have absorbed some 90% of the additional heat. Elkhorn and staghorn coral, which are native to southern Florida, Mexico, and the Caribbean, were already classified as critically endangered by the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List. Since the 1980s, they have been devastated by marine heat and disease, along with other stressors like pollution and overfishing. On Florida's coral reef, the incidence of elkhorn and staghorn had declined by 90% or more before 2023, said Ross Cunning, a coral biologist at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago and one of the study's lead authors. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. But the corals could still be found throughout the reef, bolstered by the work of restoration groups that grew and planted them. However, in the Florida Keys and Dry Tortugas, the 2023 heat wave killed off 98 to 100% of the elkhorn and staghorn that remained, the study found. Further north, off southeast Florida, the water temperatures were not as high and the corals fared better. 38% of the elkhorn and staghorn died. The loss of the staghorn and elkhorn is so significant because those species have been the dominant reef builders on Florida's coral reefs for the last 10,000 years, Dr. Cunning said. They have the fastest growth rates of Caribbean corals, and therefore they grow and build three-dimensional structures more rapidly. Other kinds of coral, like brain and boulder coral, are still prevalent in Florida's reef, and the researchers are currently analyzing the heat wave's effect on those species. Early results appear to indicate that while up to 90% of them bleached severely in 2023, they seem to have recovered relatively well. Because those species build limestone mounds as opposed to branches, he compared Florida's reef to a forest that has lost its tall trees. The study published on Thursday had 47 authors and was based on diver surveys at more than 52,000 colonies of staghorn and elkhorn coral across 391 sites. Dr. Cunning described what he saw on a diving expedition in September 2023 as carnage. We all kind of went into shock a little bit just to cope with what we were seeing. Large thickets of staghorn coral, healthy just 3 months earlier on a previous trip, were dead or dying. All the team could do, he said, was take pictures and collect data so that others would know what was happening. Mark Hickson, a professor of marine biology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, who was not involved with the research, said that the study was well respected coral scientists and forthrightly reported the functional extinction of elkhorn and staghorn corals in Florida. Unfortunately for all of us, this disaster was expected after ocean temperatures surged in 2023, yet another tragic example of nations failing to address climate disruption, he said. I personally witnessed the death of my favorite coral reef in the Bahamas during the first global coral bleaching event back in 1998. It was weird shedding tears into my face mask. The planet is currently in its fourth global bleaching event, which is the most widespread on record. This month, a group of 160 scientists asserted that extensive coral reef die-offs meant that the planet had crossed its first climate-related tipping point, threatening the livelihoods of hundreds of millions of people. Scientists expect some coral species to fare better than others. Coral restoration groups continue to grow and transplant elkhorn and staghorn to Florida's reef, and efforts are underway to help the species withstand higher temperatures. For example, scientists have crossed Florida elkhorn with a variety from Honduras that thrives in higher temperatures. In July, for the first time, these hybrid Flandurian corals were affixed onto the Florida reef. It is early days, and scaling such efforts would require tremendous resources. So far, despite more high ocean temperatures this summer, they look healthy. But even if such interventions succeed, they alone will not be enough to save reefs, scientists emphasized. If we don't stop runaway climate change, no amount of intervention and restoration is going to work, said Dr. Cunning. And I'm sorry to say, here's more bad news. Food banks nationwide brace for overwhelming need as SNAP cutoff looms. This is by Chris Hippensteel. Food banks across the United States were stretched thin even before the federal government shutdown. Rising food prices had driven a growing number of people to their doors. Cuts to federal programs had left them with less to give. Now that system, a last resort for tens of millions of hungry Americans, is anticipating an even greater surge in demand. With no end in sight to the nearly month-long federal government shutdown, funding for the nation's largest food assistance program, known as SNAP, will disappear at the start of November, according to the Department of Agriculture. On Friday, the Trump administration said in a memo that it would not tap into contingency funds to keep payments flowing to states. That means that roughly 42 million Americans who rely on SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, may soon have to find other ways to feed themselves and their families. Many of them will turn to local food pantries. Anti-hunger organizations and food banks say the surging demand will almost certainly exceed their capacity to respond, and the impact could resonate well beyond the shutdown. When that social safety net breaks above us, we will be there to do as much as we can, said Andrea Williams, president of the Oregon Food Bank, which helps supply food to roughly 1,200 pantries and meal sites across Oregon and southwest Washington, and it will not be enough. There are more than 47 million Americans who at some point during the year face food insecurity, meaning they don't have enough to eat and don't know where their next meal will come from, according to the Agricultural Department's latest report. There are millions more who don't fully fit that definition, but nonetheless turn to charitable food programs for support, according to Feeding America, a nationwide network of food banks, food pantries, and local meal programs. Since the pandemic, a steady drumbeat of inflation has substantially increased prices at the grocery store, driving more people of limited means to food banks. Visits to Ms. Williams' network of food pantries in Oregon are up 50% over the last 2 years alone, she said. Rada Mutia, the head of Capital Area Food Banks, which serves Washington, D.C., and surrounding counties in Virginia and Maryland, said visits to pantries in her service area have doubled since before the pandemic. But earlier this year, the Trump administration cut nearly $1 billion in federal aid for anti-hunger programs, including one that supplies food directly to food banks. Let me repeat that. Earlier this year, the Trump administration cut nearly $1 billion in federal aid for anti-hunger programs, including one that supplies food directly to food banks. At distribution sites in New Orleans and Detroit on Saturday, volunteers described the situation in simple terms. Demand is up, food is down. Several food bank directors who were interviewed cited the same statistic. For every 9 meals that were supplied by federal food assistance, food pantries can provide only one on their own. No matter how thin they stretch their resources, they will not be able to fill the gap if funding for SNAP does not come through. It means people will go hungry, and in particular, kids and seniors in rural communities, Ms. Williams said. In previous federal shutdowns, the outlook didn't seem quite as grim, said Joel Dixon, director of the Food Depot, which serves 9 counties in northern New Mexico, the state with the highest proportion of SNAP recipients among its residents. In those shutdowns, Ms. Dixon said, there was always the expectation that the federal government would step in to protect SNAP if monthly payments were at stake. Now, that's not the case. She compared the scale of the need for food assistance that her organization is anticipating to the early days of the pandemic, when business closures and mass layoffs sent a multitude of Americans scrambling. I think it has the potential to be bigger than that, Ms. Dixon said. Some states have taken emergency financial measures to keep aid flowing to SNAP recipients, while other states search for answers. Governor Glenn Youngkin of Virginia, a Republican, declared a state of emergency in anticipation of the cutoff. Governor Gavin Newsom of California announced plans to call up the National Guard to support food banks. And in Louisiana, where 18% of the population relies on SNAP, the second highest proportion after New Mexico, lawmakers are expected to approve using reserve funds temporarily to cover missing payments. The situation may be dire in areas with large populations of federal workers, Ms. Mutia said. The Trump administration's slashing of the federal workforce this year had already driven up food insecurity in those areas. Then the shutdown cut off paychecks for most of those who still had government jobs. Now Ms. Mutya said she expects to see the long lines for food grow even longer, and pantries that were already running low may have to turn away even more people. This could be just an inordinate number of people, she said. Cars lined up for blocks in Beltsville, Maryland on Saturday, waiting at one of several food distribution events that Ms. Mutya's network has held for federal employees who have gone for weeks without wages. After 45 minutes and 320 boxes given away, the Beltsville site ran out of food, and everyone who was still in line had to drive away empty-handed. The same thing happened a day earlier at another distribution event. To see all these federal employees have to do this, it breaks my heart, said Maria Staunton, a volunteer at the Beltsville site, who had been furloughed from a position as an auditor. With the federal job, it used to be that you didn't have to worry. It used to be a very stable job. And now for some editorials. Here's an important one by Eric Rosenbach and Chris Lee called How Trump and Xi Can Stop a War Before It Starts. On May 26, 2023, a U.S. Air Force plane was on a routine reconnaissance mission over the South China Sea when a Chinese fighter jet banked dangerously close to it. Several months earlier, over the same waters, a U.S. military plane was forced to take evasive action when a Chinese fighter came within 20 feet. Risky intercepts and unsafe encounters like these between the air and naval forces of China and the U.S. and its allies have spiked in recent years, and there appears to be no let-up. In August, China released footage of what it claimed was a near miss between Chinese and U.S. helicopters in the Taiwan Strait. Territorial confrontations between Chinese and Philippine vessels have become routine in the South China Sea, and last week Australia said that a Chinese fighter jet had released flares dangerously close to an Australian Air Force plane. The danger that one of these incidents will tip into an actual conflict has never been higher. Yet in sharp contrast to the era of U.S.-Soviet confrontation, there are virtually no reliable systems of real-time communication between American and Chinese military forces to defuse an inadvertent crisis. President Trump, who plans to meet President Xi Jinping of China this week on the sidelines of a regional summit in South Korea, has made clear that his priority with China is a trade deal. But trade depends on peace and stability. By working to lay the foundation for durable crisis management systems with China, Trump can secure his legacy as the president who pulled the two powers back from the brink of World War III. History has shown how superpower confrontation can quickly spiral toward nuclear Armageddon. The 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis is perhaps the most chilling example. The U.S. and China have also come dangerously close to blows. In 2001, a U.S. Navy spy plane collided with a Chinese fighter jet in the South China Sea. The Chinese pilot was killed, and the American aircraft made an emergency landing on China's Hainan Island, where the crew was captured. The ensuing 10-day standoff was resolved only after delicate diplomacy that reached the highest levels of the Chinese and U.S. governments. Whether that kind of crisis resolution can be replicated today is uncertain. China is far more assertive and militarily powerful than it was in 2001, and tensions with the U.S. are more combustible, amplified by nationalistic pressures on both sides. The situation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was different. Although sworn ideological adversaries, they had the wisdom to put reliable checks and balances in place. They notified each other before missile launches, agreed to a range of transparency requirements so that each side could tell that the other's activities were exercises rather than attacks, and followed safety protocols designed to reduce the chance of run-ins. These safeguards remain functional even when tensions spike. The importance of open lines of contact cannot be overestimated. In 2015, Russia dramatically increased its military presence in Syria. One of the writers of this essay assisted Ash Carter, then the U.S. Secretary of Defense, and Joe Dunford, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in reopening military communication channels with the Russians that had been severed a year earlier after Russia invaded Crimea. We took measures to avoid accidental clashes in Syria, and no such run-ins occurred. And you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. There has been a modest level of military contact between China and the U.S. over the years, but nothing that resulted in the dependable safeguard systems that existed with the Soviets. And China has repeatedly severed all military exchange out of anger, most recently in 2022, after the visit to Taiwan by Nancy Pelosi as House Speaker. President Joe Biden and Mr. Xi agreed in 2023 to reestablish military dialogue. But that agreement came late in Mr. Biden's presidency and has failed to fully take root. Communication remains precarious and insufficient, consisting of occasional phone calls between top government or military officials and other sporadic engagement. This fragile framework cannot be counted on to quickly diffuse potential accidents in the air and at sea the way regular, predictable contact can, and it remains vulnerable to rupture in tense times. There have been encouraging recent signs. Last month, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth called the Chinese Defense Minister Zhang Jun the Trump administration's first real step toward correcting this military blind spot. But one-off video calls and predictable measures like setting up hotlines are not enough. During the 2001 crisis, the U.S. ambassador to Beijing, Joe Prewer, was unable to reach senior Chinese military officials at the outset of the standoff. "They didn't answer my phone call," he said. And as the former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell, has put it, past Chinese reluctance to use hotlines means that American calls have just rung in an empty room for hours upon hours. China has hinted at a new readiness to engage. A Chinese military spokesman suggested in late September that Beijing was open to pursuing closer military relations with the U.S. in the name of greater stability. In 2017, Mr. Xi himself told General Dunford, the Joint Chiefs Chairman, that military ties can act as a stabilizing force in the broader China-U.S. relationship. He was right then, and the point becomes more relevant with each passing day. Mr. Trump should build on this momentum by creating a system of routine, sustained, real-time military contact. It could be the difference between war and peace. And now, our weekly editorial by David French. It seems from the title to be about basketball, but it's about more than that. The NBA should have known this was coming. On Thursday, the sports world faced one of its worst nightmares. The Justice Department announced the indictments of Chauncey Billups, the Portland Trail Blazers coach, and Terry Rozier, a Miami Heat guard, on gaming-related charges. I hope I said that name right. Billups, along with 30 other defendants, was charged for involvement in a mafia scheme to rig illegal poker games in New York City and across the country. Rozier and five others were charged with wire fraud and money laundering conspiracies related to a scheme in which Rozier allegedly changed his in-game behavior to rig what are called prop bets. As the indictment defines it, a prop bet, short for proposition bet, is a bet regarding the occurrence or non-occurrence during a game of an event not directly affecting the game's outcome. A gambler can wager on whether a player will score over or under a certain number of points, for example, or whether a person will make or miss a certain number of three-point shots. The indictment included a number of reported incidents of bet rigging. In one, Rozier told a co-conspirator that he was going to remove himself from a game in the first quarter, almost certainly guaranteeing that a number of key statistics would be under the amount predicted. While the Billups indictment wasn't directly related to his conduct in NBA games, the Rozier indictment claims that an NBA coach, identified only as co-conspirator 8, told one of the defendants that the Trailblazers were tanking, that is, losing on purpose in the hope of getting a better draft pick, and that a number of key players would be sitting out an upcoming game, allowing gamblers, except now they were no longer gambling, to wager against the team. The biographical details, including the dates he played and the dates he coached, of co-conspirator 8 match up with Billups. After Billups and Rozier were arrested, the NBA placed both of them on immediate leave. These indictments aren't the only example of deeply concerning behavior connected to sports betting. On October 17th, ESPN reported that sportsbooks flagged dozens of suspicious bets made by gamblers repeatedly wagering against the same small conference teams in at least 11 men's college basketball games over 6 weeks last season. The bets may be related to an existing gambling investigation. The ESPN report said that the games mentioned involve 5 of the 6 schools where the NCAA says 13 former players are under investigation for participating in gambling schemes. If you follow sports at all, you will have noticed that sports betting is everywhere. Ads for betting sites such as DraftKings and FanDuel blanket the airwaves. ESPN has even gotten in on the action, starting its own sports book called ESPN Bet, and ads for ESPN Bet are virtually omnipresent on ESPN's on-screen graphics. This led to an amusing moment on Thursday when ESPN reporters were commenting on the gambling scandal while the ESPN Bet ad was still on the screen. It was removed mid-segment. Sports betting has both expanded and changed. It expanded in large part because of a 2018 Supreme Court case, Murphy versus National Collegiate Athletic Association, which struck down the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act. This act prohibited state-sanctioned sports gambling, but grandfathered in the sports gambling laws in Nevada, Oregon, and Delaware. After the Murphy case, sports gambling exploded in popularity and reach. It's legal in some forms in 39 states, plus Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico. In 2024, the sports betting industry earned $13.71 billion in revenue. The nature of gambling has also changed. Rather than simply betting on the outcome or point spread of games, gamblers can now use their betting apps to place live prop bets minute by minute within the game. This has a slot machine style effect on gamblers, who keep feeding their apps money, transfixed by each new bet. While there are millions of people who can gamble responsibly, there are also millions who cannot. In a piece for the Free Press, a reporter named Zach Bissonnette chronicled some of the worst effects. He wrote, "The National Council on Problem Gambling reports that sports bettors develop an addiction at twice the rate of other gamblers." In addition, a recent Maryland study found that 19.8% of online sports bettors in the state engage in disordered gambling, the kind of gambling, in other words, where someone does it compulsively and damages their life in the process, with another 31% at risk. That means that half of all online sports bettors are either dysfunctional or are in danger of dysfunction. Even worse, gambling addiction also has the highest rate of suicide of all addictions. If addiction and suicide weren't bad enough, a 2025 study found a substantial increase in average bankruptcy rates, debt sent to collections, use of debt consolidation loans, and auto loan delinquencies in states after the legalization of online sports betting. I'm dispositionally libertarian and suspicious of government regulation in the absence of compelling evidence that it's necessary. I also confess to being gambling curious. I'm the ideal target for an entrepreneurial sports book. I love sports. I'm highly competitive. And like so many sports fans, or maybe all sports fans, I have a wildly inflated belief in my own knowledge of sports. I'll find myself frustrated by coaching decisions that, truthfully, I barely understand. And I question draft choices as if I could step in as the general manager of a professional basketball team. So when a friend sent me a, quote, free opportunity to bet $150 on a betting app, I think of this as the sports equivalent of one free hit on the crack pipe, I took the bait and lost every dime in exactly 2 hours. Like the proverbial toddler who touches a hot stove, I learned my lesson. I haven't touched the app since. But I also saw the appeal firsthand. After all, I'm only one bet away from winning back everything I lost, and then some. Don't I know more about the Memphis Grizzlies than some odds maker in Vegas? That's how it happens. That's how you get pulled back in. Sports betting may be too big to ban. It's a huge industry, and it has been popular enough to be enacted in some states through referendums. But as more Americans experience its high cost, it's losing public support. At the very least, there is a desperate need for at least some reform, and a great place to start would be with prop bets, which I mentioned earlier, the bets on the performance of individual players and other in-game moments that have that obsessive slot machine effect on gamblers and create perverse incentives for players at the same time. As Rozier demonstrated, individual bets on individual players can give the player absolute control over the outcome for many gamblers. Players can enrich themselves and their confederates, at least until they're caught. And no one should think for a minute that these arrests mean that we've either solved the problem of gambling-related corruption or created enough of a deterrent to prevent corruption in the future. The evidence is now in. The explosive growth in sports gambling is bad for sports, and most important, it has proved to be bad for the millions of Americans who gamble past the point of prudence and move directly to the point of pain. The sports gambling revolution needs more regulation. It may even need termination. And one last editorial here by Kathleen Kingsbury, who's the opinion editor of the Times, and W.J. Hennigan, who writes about national security issues for the opinion section from Washington. And this is called So Lifelike as to Be Terrifying. And it's about a new movie on Netflix, which I wouldn't ordinarily promote, but it sounds really interesting. Because it deals with some important issues. A House of Dynamite is a taut, high-stakes thriller directed by Kathryn Bigelow that centers on a looming nuclear threat. The film delves into the complexities of global politics and personal sacrifice as characters navigate a tense and unpredictable situation when an unidentified ballistic missile enters American airspace. It's already in theaters and started streaming on Netflix on Friday. But how realistic is the scenario that A House of Dynamite depicts? For more than a year, Time's opinion series At the Brink has been exploring the modern nuclear age and the unique risks the current moment holds. The opinion editor, Kathleen Kingsbury, asked the lead writer of the series, W.J. Hennigan, just how worried filmgoers should be. And it says in parentheses, mild spoilers below. So Kathleen Kingsbury asks, as the movie begins, there's a lot of confidence that what the White House Situation Room is watching is a harmless missile test. Is there any history of real false alarms? Hennigan responds, oh, sure, there's been several. Perhaps the scariest incident occurred in the fall of 1983, when tensions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union were particularly bad. In September of that year, the USSR shot down a Korean air jet that had taken off from New York because the military mistakenly thought It was an American spy plane. All 269 people, including a U.S. congressman, were killed. And I have to interrupt to say that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A few weeks later, Soviet satellites detected that five U.S. missiles were heading toward the USSR. Fortunately, Stanislav Petrov, a duty officer at the time, had a funny feeling about what he was seeing. He thought it was strange that if the U.S. were willing to gamble with the Armageddon, it would do so with just a handful of missiles. He deliberately disobeyed military protocol, ignored the warning because he believed it to be false, and didn't relay the affair to senior leadership, thereby sidestepping any potential Soviet retaliatory strikes. Good thing he did. What the satellites had detected was the sun's reflection off the clouds, not a missile attack. There's a documentary that was made about this called The Man Who Saved the World. Kingsbury asks, so basically it came down to one man's gut instinct to save us from nuclear war. I bet many moviegoers who saw A House of Dynamite were surprised when the fictional president is asked to make the decision over whether to retaliate in only a matter of minutes before the missiles even hits. Is that how the process works? Hennigan replies, yes. As we wrote about in our series, the U.S. president would have about 15 minutes to decide what to do in response to an incoming nuclear weapon. Once a launch is detected, which would happen immediately, it would take a bit for U.S. intelligence to sort out details on the missile, the warhead, the weapon's trajectory, and its estimated point of impact. Once that's completed, the government would have some idea about casualties and fallout zones. Kingsbury asks, and while in the film there is a Navy officer who explains the president's options, the president is the only person who ultimately gets to make this decision. Hennigan, right. We live in a nuclear monarchy. Only the president has the decision power to respond with a nuclear attack. It's a quirk to our democratic system that the commander-in-chief has unchecked authority over the nuclear arsenal. There have been various efforts by Congress to rein that power in, but no bill has come close to passing. Kingsbury, I found the movie so lifelike as to be terrifying. Did you have any specific critiques of the accuracy of its portrayal? Hennigan, I didn't see any flaws. The only thing I raised an eyebrow out was the missile early warning satellite going down. So U.S. intelligence couldn't figure out who was responsible for the launch. There are several of those satellites which detect the infrared emissions from the heat blasts emanating from missiles and rocket launches. So the redundancy would ensure the United States' early warning system wasn't entirely blind. But I felt it was clever as a plot device to add intrigue. Kingsbury. In the film, the United States is trying desperately to speak to counterparts in China and Russia and struggles to even get them on the phone. We read about this before. Much less get answers on who has launched this strike. What systems are in place in the real world to ensure that there is a better communication in such a scenario? Hennigan. Washington has maintained a hotline with Moscow since the potentially disastrous Cuban missile crisis of October 1962. I saw what this arrangement looked like last year when I went to the National Nuclear Risk Reduction Center at the State Department. There, government officials sit all day, every day, to facilitate the information exchanges, mostly between the U.S. and Russia, that are required by decades-old arms control treaties and security-building agreements. The United States doesn't have the same setup with China, but the White House does have the means to reach Chinese leadership if an emergency arises. All governments recognize the necessity to maintain these kinds of hotlines. No one wants a mistake or a miscalculation to spiral out of control. Kingsbury. A House of Dynamite depicts a scene where the military tries to use our missile defense apparatus to knock down the fictional projectile. There, the Secretary of Defense is surprised to learn that missile defense only has about a 60% chance of success. Are those the real odds? Hennigan. Yes, it's about 55%. So as the SecDef in the film says, It's basically a coin toss. The defense system against ICBMs is called ground-based mid-course defense. It basically involves just 44 long-range interceptors installed in silos in Alaska and California. The system is designed to blast apart a handful of missiles launched by a rogue actor like North Korea or Iran. But if Russia or China launched the hundreds of nuclear-tipped missiles that they possess, the system would be overwhelmed and American cities would be helpless. The United States has already spent billions on the system, and there's much more spending to come, thanks to Trump's plan for a Golden Dome, which will expand our defenses. It's also worth pointing out that while the ground-based mid-course defense has been successful 55% of the time, these were in highly scripted tests where the military generally knew what to expect. War doesn't work that way, of course. Hitting an intercontinental ballistic missile as it travels thousands of miles per hour is no easy feat. The metaphor most often used in military circles is hitting a bullet with a bullet, which the film mentions. Kingsbury. But we saw last year Israel effectively take down hundreds of Iranian missiles before they hit, with some help from the U.S. and other allies. Hennigan. This is true, but Israel is the size of New Jersey. Not a lot of guesswork as to what targets the missiles are headed toward. The other thing about Israel's Iron Dome defense is that it typically intercepts relatively slow, often unguided projectiles lobbed from nearby, not the intercontinental ballistic missile that you see in the film. Everything needs to work in concert: radars, satellite sensors, interceptors, analytical assessments, in order to detect, track, and engage inbound ICBMs. Kingsbury, one of the more human parts of the film, is watching as the president and other senior officials are hustled off to bunkers while the few others who know that the bomb could soon hit are left to suffer the impact. It's gut-wrenching and some of the strongest acting. Tell us more about those bunkers. How sure are we that they could actually survive a nuclear bomb? Hennigan. In the 1950s, at the beginning of the Cold War, the government built a series of secret subterranean lairs in rural Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia. The most well-known one, which is in the film, is called Raven Rock. Most of what I know about this site is from Garrett Graff's 2017 book on the site, which he reports was built to accommodate about 1,400 people in multiple structures. It's encased in granite and happens to be on springs, so it can sway as the ICBMs thunder down more than a quarter mile above. They've obviously never been tested in a real-life all-out thermonuclear attack, but the goal of this facility is continuity of government, ensuring that our democratic leaders survive to govern whatever survives the attack amid smoldering radioactive ash. Kingsbury. You visited the U.S. Strategic Command in Nebraska for At the Brink. It plays a big role in the movie. What does A House of Dynamite get right or wrong about that command? Hennigan. What we saw in the film was the spitting image of the battle deck, which is the command center buried below Stratcom's headquarters. Maybe the filmmakers used the photos from our series, but I couldn't see a single flaw in the set design. As for the protocol and conversations among military and political leaders, I also found that to be accurate. The president is briefed on the threat and then is confronted with the unimaginable choice of whether and how to retaliate. Millions of lives are at stake. We should all hope that nightmare never becomes a reality. I guess we live in a dangerous world. And I want to conclude with a letter to the editor. There was an article last week that blamed baby boomers for the state of the world, and a lot of people responded. And here's just one response. This is from Leslie Millinson of Chicago. Millennials and Gen Zers, want to change the world for the better? How about voting? A recent Tufts University analysis showed that only 47% of people aged 18 to 29 voted in 2024. Now, our democracy, which boomers fought to protect for the past 60 years, is being dismantled. The civil rights, racial, gender, and sexual orientation freedoms they realized are disappearing. You are complaining about a generation that created the Environmental Protection Agency and fought to successfully enact laws guaranteeing education for children with disabilities and to ensure that women and minorities had equal access to civil rights and career success. You are complaining about a generation that is leaving government service in droves, some fired, some quitting, because your generation's low voter turnout helped elect an anti-democratic autocrat. If you're unhappy with the way things are, as boomers were when we hit voting age, then do something about it, just as we did. Stop blaming us and start working to make positive change. Good point. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 27th edition of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This is Ted. I hope you enjoyed it, and I look forward to being with you again next week. Thank you for listening. Bye.